Jay Beam and Jay Savitri, everyone. I'm Tanmori Soundarajan, and this is Cast in the United States with First Post. Today's episode is an exploration of how caste privilege gets developed. Joining us is Shambhu. Shambhu is a Brahmin in the diaspora who has done a lot of unlearning caste supremacy work with other dominant caste people all throughout the United States. And we wanted to bring him on so that we could explore caste from the lens of caste privilege. We know a lot about what it is to be Dalit, but we don't know what it is to be able to build a Brahmin. This is where Shambhu comes in. He's going to talk a little bit about what it was like to learn his privilege and also what are the steps to take to unlearn it. Shambhu, so nice for you to join us. And I'm wondering if you can share, what was it like to grow up Brahmin and really paint a picture for our audience of how caste hegemony was imprinted on you from a young age?
Yes, I am a Brahmin. Just to give you a little bit of background of who I am and where I come from, I'm a Brahmin from South Kannada or Dakshin Kannada, which is the southern part of Karnataka, which borders Kerala. I primarily grew up in Mumbai, but I have all of my relatives basically in southern Karnataka or South Kannada. We grew up with stories that are, you know, embedded in Brahminism that include kind of the Mahabharata or the Ramayana. Used to hear stories about that all the time. In terms of hierarchy, you know, you are not allowed to question those who are elder or those who are above you. That's one of the things that is taught really early on and kind of embedded in you right from the beginning, right? That those who are your elders or those who are your quote-unquote betters know better. And so decisions more or less that they make is something that is for your own betterment. So it's not something that you question. So in a sense, kind of hierarchy is imbued right up from the beginning in some ways for a Brahmin. But you are also told very definitively that as a Brahmin man, you are the quote-unquote best of the best. And so everyone else basically is subordinate to you in some way or the other. In a word, as long as you're a Brahmin, you're told basically that you are part of this special group of people who are privileged. We don't call it privilege. It's more in terms of we are told that this is exactly how the world is supposed to be, where you are on top of a hierarchy. And that's primarily driven by the fact that, quote unquote, you've had good karma in your previous lives, you know, you've done really good deeds, and that's why you've landed up being a Brahmin today. So that's something that's, again, embedded and imbued in Brahmins really early on. And what that also translates to is basically, again, you're taught to look down on other people early on. And Dakshin Kannada or South Kannada has been kind of a hotbed of right-wing Brahminism in many ways for a long, long time now. And it emanates from a lot from the community that I'm a part of, right? In terms of Brahminism, we continue to get taught that, yes, you are better than everyone else. So be it school, be it public spaces or wherever it is, your parents or your relatives consciously make comments or consciously make comparisons with other folks who might be your friends, right? They'll always say, oh, the question always starts, where's he from or who is he, right? And who is he is not simply about the individual, but actually his family and very consciously the caste that that person comes from. So those are some of the things that early on, you know, start your brain to think in a certain way around the people that you're associated with, the people that you're connected with, and who you're supposed to be connected with and who you're supposed to be associated with. So there's always these codes that are being used, like, oh, he's from a good family, or she's from a good family, or they are very good people, or they're, you know, don't associate with them, right? You know, they'll always betray you, or some version of that is something that you always hear as you're growing up. And that's somehow subconsciously part of you as you grow up. So that's a lot of how my childhood was. We had, to be honest, the opportunity to go abroad because of my dad's last name. That opportunity was afforded to us. And because of that, we had an opportunity to go abroad. So I spent about, I would say, 9 years abroad in very formative years as well. And even during that time, we went to a country in Africa. We went to Nairobi, Kenya. And so even there, even prior to going, or even there, for example, the diasporic community that we were part of is very exclusive and very discriminatory in many ways, not just amongst Indians, but also very anti-Black. And again, primarily the folks that were there as part of the contingent that did go abroad were mostly upper caste and mostly actually Brahmin. And so, again, the conversations there is more in terms of, for example, looking down on the African folks who are working with, for example, my dad and his colleagues, that the fact that they cannot, quote unquote, manage their own affairs, and that's why they need Indians to come from the diaspora. Indians is a very loose term, which often used by the diaspora for upper caste Brahmins, right? As you folks probably know already, but that's how it's used in the sense that in quote unquote Indians have to come in and manage affairs for them. So a very anti-Black, very, you know, exclusive club of people who actually manage affairs for other folks. That's kind of, again, the impression, very formative years for me growing up. That's what you hear all the time. And back home in India, for example, you always also hear the same thing being talked about, Dalits or Muslims, a very othering sense, in the sense that, you know, the people, they're here because of, again, stuff that they've done in their past lives. They deserve to be where they are. They're lazy, not hardworking enough. And that's why, again, obviously, in Brahmin communities, unfortunately, it always comes down to reservation as well. So there'll always be this, you know, take that, oh, they need reservation because they're not good enough. So there's always that take that's kind of a standard that's part of discourse in growing up in a Brahmin household. And you see this more so also in the villages of Dakshin Kannada or South Kannada, where there is still practiced, for example, some folks cannot eat with you within your house. People who are working for you are always served outside and not within inside the house. You don't necessarily let them in into your household, so to speak. So in every house in Dakshin Kannada, for example, is also sanctum sanctorum, where God is quote-unquote placed. Again, non-Brahmins are not allowed in that sanctum sanctorum. Because folks that my parents associated with, my relatives associated with, were again largely Brahmin and upper caste, and almost I would say 90% Brahmin, you don't get to see any other point of view other than Brahminism, right? And that is deeply imbued in every fiber of your being in some ways. And so you don't think of these things as being artificial or extraordinary. You're not taught that, or you're taught not to see that, right? So yes, everyone who comes to the house, we believe, can actually go and pray to God, which is not true, right? Because yes, you have seen everyone who has come to your house go and pray to God. But the primary driver of that is the fact that they're all Brahmin. If anyone else comes, they'll not be even allowed within inside the house. Servants or domestic workers or even workers in the fields in Dakshin Kannada, for example, are treated in a certain way. Like I said, they're given their food outside the house. They're not necessarily allowed to enter the house unless they have actually a particular task to do, like cleaning up the house, etc. And so, again, that is taught as being normal. And so these are some of the ways that I would say really break down your critical thinking in some ways, and you're taught not to see certain things which are obviously discriminatory, obviously unfair, that I look back, frankly, disgusting.
Thank you for sharing that perspective, Shambhu. How does it feel as a child to see this level of kind of segregation and separate places for people, separate eating utensils? How does it feel as a child to witness that?
Just because of how it's imbued in us all through childhood, right? There's no feeling of there's something off. It might be just my personal lack of critical thinking at that point of time while growing up and stuff like that too. But just you believe that that's normal. You believe that this is how things are supposed to be. This is how things are supposed to work. You do not think about the humanity of other people. You're actively taught that this is how people are supposed to be. This is how the natural order of things are. So you don't necessarily question that, right? Again, I might be speaking about me personally. There might be other people who might have reflected on this in a different way growing up Brahmin, but I didn't for sure, right? So you see that difference. You see that other people not being treated in the same way you are treated, but you believe that that's exactly how the world is supposed to work. You're not taught otherwise. And why would you be taught otherwise, right? At the end of the day, you're on top of a hierarchy that's been on top of that hierarchy for generations, if not a couple of thousand years. There's no reason for you to question that hierarchy when you are the beneficiaries of that hierarchy. So frankly speaking, growing up, I believe that was the way it is. And when I say growing up, to be honest, to my utter shame, it went all the way, I would say, all the way up to my mid-20s, I would say, right? In some ways that I was continuing to believe that this is how things were supposed to be. And I refused to question until a point of time where that belief was untenable with everything that I was, again, seeing around me. But yeah, up until then, I felt growing up that was absolutely normal and there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, and I think this is a really important point. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, Shambhu, because, you know, we do a lot of unlearning caste supremacy work together. And, you know about the workshops that we do. And mm-hmm. It was really striking to me that someone who went to our workshops actually participated in a deep act of casteism afterwards. And to me, I thought, you know, what was so striking about that is that the continuance of caste privilege is not actually simply a cognitive function, meaning that it's not just about like, oh, if people know the truth, if people actually read Ambedkar or they go through trainings or workshops or what have you, that caste can be so quickly dismantled, right? And there's actually a very deep behavioral component that comes from childhood training that also comes from trauma. And I think this is where the work of, you know, thinkers like Resma Menakem is so useful, because in his work around thinking about dismantling race, as a psychologist, he thinks about white supremacy as also a trauma response. And he talks about white supremacy as white body supremacy, that there are some responses related to race that happened at the body level because of the violence that is experienced by everybody on all sides of racial divides. And so that there are particular experiences those who are racially oppressed feel, but also those who benefit from white privilege also are socialized into. And I think that really goes into, you know, Mari's question and also your response, is that when children are exposed at such a young age to violent divides of society, there is something that happens that is very profound, that takes another kind of shattering of your worldview that has been developed before you are willing to challenge, you know, deeply held beliefs that have been with you since you were trained as a young person. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what I want to speak to a little bit, because I think, you know, particularly in the way that, you know, we met, Shambhu, one thing that you talk very poignantly about is about shedding the thread, or this sacred Brahminical thread that people train and carry as Brahmin men. And can you talk a little bit about that moment for you, and also what it was like? Because I think there's a lot of fascination around, like, you know, what happens, like what is so esoteric that is learned that helps create that divide. And I ask this from a very personal level, because I remember being an undergrad in college, and there was this, you know, Indian kid who was, you know, a diaspora kid, and this guy was like the Mr. Woke that you could ever think about. Like, anytime there was a protest, you know, for Black rights, he was there. He was like, he lived in the Mecha house, which is the house for Chicano rights, you know, that came out of Chicano movement. And he was like such the star of the person that lived in that house. They gave him an honorary award at the end of the year. So he was like woker than woke, right? But this guy came to my house afterwards, and he was telling me about how he spent the summer at his grandmother's house after he just talked about getting this award and talking about woke things. Mm-hmm. And at his grandmother's house over the summer, he was really excited about his thread. And he said, you know, I forgot what it's like to be able to be in a place where I have power. And he was talking about, you know, his experience of racism here. And he said, but back home, I have power. You know, with my thread, I can tell anybody I want anything that I want. And he said that to me in my home as a Dalit person, and he didn't think at all about, you know, while he's talking about flexing the power and privilege of his thread, he didn't see it at all in contradiction with his fight for racial justice, or that he was using his like relief in Brahmanism as a response to white supremacy, and he didn't see a hypocrisy with that. So I'm just wondering, you know, let's start with shed the thread and then let's go down into that conversation a little bit.
Sure. As part of my journey, and just to let you folks know and your listeners as well, after I came to the United States, which was in my late 20s, with that I actually started using what I would like to call critical thinking. Again, coming in contact with, in terms of journey, like through NGOs that were kind of left-leaning. But again, in those spaces, let me be very clear, caste is not addressed, right? There's huge disparities. And being in the diaspora by myself, in some ways, I, again, sought out the same quote-unquote good people, the people who look like me and who have same quote-unquote backgrounds, right? Which is, again, like code at the end of the day for caste, right? As we all know. And I found some of those in liberal NGO spaces. And so that's where I gravitated towards. So that's where some of my critical thinking actually started. But to be honest, I was not introduced to Ambedkar or any of the other Bahujan writers before I met you, to be honest. It was that talk at Stanford, if you remember, 7 years ago, I want to say. At that time, when I actually, started engaging more with the question around caste. And you helped me open my eyes in so many ways that you have no idea. But so just to that moment as well. So one of the things we do when we are in Dakshin Kannada or South Kendra is we go to temples, right? When you're with family, when you're back home, my parents are devout Brahmins and Hindus in some ways. You always go to the temples of that are patronized by Brahmins and other folks, and they're considered good temples in South Kendra. So we went back there. And so one of the things I saw, and this was, again, around my mid-20s, right? One of the things that was really bizarre for me was basically going into, and I had some of my friends along as well, who are not Brahmin, right? But who are nevertheless Savarna and upper caste. One of the things that they do in these temples is, again, within the Sanctum Sanctorum, everyone is obviously allowed to have quote-unquote darshan, which is just look at the deity and offer prayers and obeisance and so on and so forth. But privilege to actually go into the Sanctum Sanctorum and, for example, touch the idol or get blessings from the idol directly, which is super privilege, is only reserved for Brahmins, right? And so the way they do that is basically all the men have to take off their shirts or whatever they're wearing to display the thread that, you know, marks you out as a Brahmin before you can actually go into the Sanctum Sanctorum. And so that was one really like profound moment for me to kind of understand the place of what it means to be a Brahmin, right? Everything else before that I used to take for granted, but because I had friends who were not Brahmin, they had to stay out of the Sanctum Sanctorum while I could go in with my family. So that is something that left a deep impact on me, but also kind of I was going through a phase where I was very actively seeking quote-unquote Hindu unity in some ways. And so that was the start of actually me thinking that, oh, the caste system is not really particularly good, right? Because now I had friends who were not necessarily Brahmin. And that kind of prompted me to start thinking about shedding my thread. But then over time, again, like I said, I would still have it on just because of the fact that, you know, oh, family pressures. And that's how a lot of upper caste men justify this too, right? Like, oh, these family pressures. I don't want to hurt my parents. I don't want to hurt my relatives. My grandma will feel really bad if this happens, that happens, and so on and so forth. But I think for me, once I came to the US and I had these conversations with you folks in terms of understanding what privilege is and what it affords me and what brings to me, that's where I think I made an active decision to actually stop wearing my thread at that point of time. And I made an active thing in some ways by letting my parents know that I would not be wearing that. No matter what the ceremony, no matter what event that we are going to as a family, it's not something that is acceptable to me anymore. And hence, you know, I did take it off. And in many spaces, I do get mocked or, you know, asked about it a lot of the times. But now they tend to think that, oh, you're in the US now. So I can see how that is okay for you to now take off your thread kind of thing. Or I understand, for example, you're not necessarily tied to your culture anymore. That's how it gets interpreted as. But yeah, that was kind of one of the profound moments as I was growing up for me in terms of triggering some critical thinking on my part.
Can I ask, like, in terms of, you know, why people want the thread on, is it because, like, that just shows that you're part of that inner circle? So it's controversial because you're basically laying down the privilege, correct?
In some ways it is, but you really never lose the privilege, right? It is controversial in the sense that, it is part of your identity, and it identifies you as a good person, quote unquote, again. And that you're following traditions, you're following all the diktats of the Vedas and so on and so forth that have supposedly been laid down for you, and that marks you out as a good person. Now, that's more of what it is. But you never really lose that privilege, to be honest, because again, your parents or your close family or your relatives, they all stand up for you anyways, right? You go to a Brahmin space, as long as you're not alone, you're with your friends or your relatives, then you are still part of that network and you're still identified as part of that network. So you never really necessarily lose that privilege. Yes, like I said, some level of ridicule and some level of, you're very smart now, you don't care about traditions, etc. You know, like snide comments, but your privilege really isn't touched, to be honest, within that framework.
So then I think then something that's really helpful, I think, for our listeners to know is that there are many people who come from dominant caste backgrounds who are listening to this podcast. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, knowing your own journey and also some of the people that you've had conversations with, I'm just wondering, what do you think are some of the road bumps that Savarnas face in really, you know, dropping their privilege? But also, how do you handle the family disagreements? Because it actually feels like there's your own internal critical thinking that's important, but then you're constantly having to face a battle within your networks of privilege. So what are things that help you as you begin that journey?
That's a good question. I think for me, at the beginning of the journey, I think reading helped a lot. Again, I'm not very well versed in all of Baba Saheb's works, but Annihilation of Caste and some of his speeches and works that had a really profound impact on me. And you have to actively want to understand anti-caste perspectives, right? And for that, you need to go to Bahujan and Dalit folks to have that discussion. I think not as in some ways, like as a consumer of it, right? But also as an active listener. I think that's where a lot of people that I've seen, for example, they'll pay lip service to the idea of an anti-caste movement or quote unquote passing the mic or using your privilege to move the movement forward without centering yourself. I think that is really hard for a Brahmin and an upper caste person, to be honest. It's very, very hard. You are taught you are the quote unquote center of the universe, right? Why would you displace yourself from there, right? It's very hard psychologically to be able to do that. I think I want to answer that question first, and more like, I think that's a really hard piece to do. You are by default hardwired to want to be the center of attention, to want to be the person who's celebrated, you want to be the hero. It's imbued in you that you are, quote-unquote, the leader. You are the person who has to take charge. You have to defeat casteism yourself, kind of thing. And that's how a lot of upper caste and upper caste men especially see themselves, right? So you'll see them taking a lot of space in Dalit and Bahujan and Adivasi spaces, as we've seen over and over again, right? You'll see them talking over Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi folks. You'll see them talking for even Muslims in many cases, right? It's so bizarre now for me to see that, but I can totally see where that is coming from. And let me be very clear, like, to a large extent, I'm complicit in that too. In many ways, I have been, taking up space in spaces that I'm not supposed to be in, right? Or I should leave that space. So it's been a learning for me, right? So that's part of it. But the second part of it, in terms of disagreements with family, I found that to a large extent, you have to navigate it on your own to see where the boundaries are. With my immediate family, to be honest, I've had disagreements with my parents for a long, long time now, especially after coming to the United States and, again, interacting with Baba Saheb's works, with folks in the diaspora who identify as Dalit, Bahujan and Adivasi. It's been quite a journey. Again, my parents are devout Brahmins and Hindus, as well as the fact that supporters of extreme right-wing politics. So that's been where the disagreements stem from. It's been very, very challenging, I'll be very honest. Like for almost 5 years or so, we went back and forth. There's shouting matches. There's, moments of silence as there are in some families where you don't talk to each other for a long period of time, et cetera, et cetera. We've come to kind of a tacit understanding that we will not talk about certain topics at this point because it immediately sets off either my dad or me or some other family member, close family member, right? Just because of some comments and stuff like that. That doesn't mean, again, that we're not triggered by it, right? You see, when we actually go to India, you see the news cycles or you see some casual comments being made by my parents or some, you know, it. There's something that always like strikes you and sometimes you cannot speak about it. But sometimes that you can also speak about it and still be very safe. You're amongst your relatives and there's, again, there's a way for them to rationalize not thinking about stuff like that by saying that, oh, now you're in the US. So you don't have to, you know, worry about traditions and stuff like that. You have changed or whatever it is, right? They dismiss some of these arguments and discussions with that altogether. And so I've seen that happen as well in many spaces. For example, there are times when I've talked to, on my maternal side, my mom's uncles and stuff like that about Ram. The story is very caste in its outset, how it's very, misogynistic, how it's so unfair to Sita, for example, and stuff like that. And they're like, obviously they don't want to hear it, but they're also, they immediately put on that lens of, oh, now you're in the US kind of thing, right? So it becomes a kind of protection for me as well as for them not to not talk about the topic, how much ever you prick it, right? And so that's something that continues to happen. But also in real ways, for example, a non-participation in, let's say, household rituals, right, that take place in front of, amongst Brahmins is still the tradition of having yagnas and stuff like that, or, the fire sacrifice. So non-participation in some of that stuff, or even if you go to, let's say, a larger family function, you don't necessarily bow in front of the deity and stuff like that. That, again, is seen as an eccentricity more than a conscious choice on your part. That's how a lot of how my privilege works as well, right? Being a Brahmin man, they're like, okay, fine. If you don't want to do it, you don't do it, but you're still part of the club kind of thing, right? So it offers some protection as long as you don't probe too deep or dig too deep and point things out very, very starkly. So that's something that I've always seen. In terms of disagreements up to a certain point are tolerated. After that, it becomes shouting matches amongst close family, amongst extended family. It's more like, you're so smart now because you're in the US, you don't understand how things really work.
And Shambhu, I think that's actually really important what you're saying, is that challenging Brahminical structures in your family is actually the most intimate and hardest work that you do. And, you know, I want to flag that there's actually many dominant caste people who are challenging casteism across many faiths, because, you know, while caste has its origin in Hindu scriptures, we see it across many different faiths at this point. But I think that one of the unifying experiences that we keep seeing is that, you know, there is a loneliness and a cultural loss when you start to pull yourself out of the rituals that have helped build your family. And also when you're in conflict with your family over certain positions that you're taking. And I think other techniques I've seen other people use has been to, you know, always carry love in your heart when you're trying to build these conversations, because it is really about moving everyone to a place where there is more inclusion, and to also like heal these very violent divides that have split us from each other as society and as people of conscience. And so sometimes you have a conversation that is really explosive, but other times there's conversations you have which, you know, actually help move the needle. And another thing that I've seen is people really get respite from chosen family. So making sure that they have allies who are also doing this work with each other to talk about strategies and also to tactics that work, but also just so that there isn't something that we're asking here where you're removing something without replacing it with love and empathy and human connection. And And I think I just wanted to, you know, give you like some of the last words to think about, you know, what is some of the chosen family that you built around this issue? And what, you know, if you were to give advice, like one very strong piece of advice to someone who's starting this road, what would it be?
I think more than anything else, it's about listening. We've been brought up in a very insular society, in a very insular community as Brahmins, that we are not open to hearing or listening to other points of view or other ideas. I think listening is a very critical component of the growth that we need to have as a community, right? And we are a community in many ways. And so that would be definitely the one piece of advice. But also, I think about materially using your privilege if you can, right? If you're in a position where you can actually materially make a difference to the movement, moving that anti-caste discussion forward, not just amongst your family and friends, but also by centering Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi folks, by materially contributing to them moving forward, that's going to be a big step. Again, you might not agree with everything that they do. You might not agree in terms of some tactics, might not agree in terms of strategy. That's not your place to make that decision. It's not. And that's the piece that a lot of Brahmin, especially men, need to understand that, look, your opinions are valuable in that only if you're called in to give them. Until that point, it's not your place to opine or, you know, make decisions for or, you know, move things forward. That does not mean an end to your critical thinking, but nevertheless, it's not your space to be there to pass judgment, seemingly, on what the Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi folks are doing to move the movement forward. They need to be the leaders, and they are the leaders of this movement, and you need to center them and not you. Again, it's a very hard concept for the Brahmin men to understand, but I think that is part of the critical growth that needs to happen. I'm still trying to learn that. I'm still a long way off, but that's then more what I would say basically in terms of offering advice or thoughts on that.
Thank you for joining us, Shambhu, and thank you to all of our listeners, and we look forward to catching you on our next episode. Until then, Jay Beam and Jay Savitri, everyone.